Thank you, thank you, thank you. Appreciate it. My name is Maren Harwood, grateful recovered alcoholic. Thanks you guys for having me. I don't know if you have much of a choice now. I'm in. I'm just kidding. There's a few new folks here tonight, so I was blessed enough to go with my family into Philadelphia today, and we went and saw Shun Yun, which is like a Chinese cultural dance. It was pretty cool. It was at the Miller Theater, right in the center of Philadelphia, and it was cool because it was a mashing of cultures, right? So they were talking about, you know, decades old dance tribes and decades old way they would communicate, and it was cool. It was very educational. My kids loved it. It was awesome. But it rounded the corner earlier just now when we were kind of, and I was thinking like, well, where are we going to start tonight? And probably our best place to start to kind of tie in that, how, you know, we're generally folks who would not normally meet or be together. There's a part in the big book, right in the beginning, in chapter 2, there is a solution where it talks about that. But it tells us we have one commonality, and I'll give you one hint, it's not alcohol. Okay? So here it is. There is a solution, which, by the way, is a promise in the big book, right? If you want to follow along, it's on page 17. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were just as once hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They solved the drink problem. How promising is that already, right? This is the kind of thing where I've been to big book meetings, and I'll put my air quotes up, right, for big book meetings, where they read an entire chapter, and then they go ahead and share about their day. See, the difference is, so a sentence just like this, nearly all have recovered, they solved the drink problem, right? If we solve the drink problem, what does that leave? That leaves the think problem, right? Because every time I relapsed, I did it sober. So alcohol is not my problem. My thinking is my problem, right? So it tells me the problem that they solved. What is the continual problem they'll be working on? The thinking, right? Because they haven't worked any steps yet in chapter 2. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. So it's talking about after a shipwreck, right, and everyone's rescued, camaraderie, everyone loves each other when that happens, right? Everything is awesome. And he talks about from steerage to captain's table. Steerage is down typically in the very bowels and below of the ship. That's where the help would typically sleep on top of each other like sardines, right? And then the captain's table is obviously up at the very top, where there's just a few select folks that would be sitting at this big giant captain's table. Plenty of space, lots of good food, right? So he's giving you a visualization of what we are. Literally, look around in this room. 100%. People who maybe normally would not mix, but here we are, right? And then the positive, the joyousness, he says, and democracy that pervade the vessel, right, from steerage to captain's table, is, right, the moment after rescue. Unlike feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. So he's dropping down a little bit there, like, okay, we were rescued, great. Now what? Right, that's the tough part. Like, we found the solution, we found an answer. There is hope. Great. Now what? Right, we can find, like, hope is good. Hope is eternal. Hope brings us in the door. I might not have walked into my first AA meeting hopeful to get well. I actually walked into AA hoping that they would kick me out because I was too young. But when I came in here, I did. There was something there. There was something to it. There was a hope element involved in that, right? The feeling of having shared in common peril is one element in a powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. So it tells me the problem, right? It's part of the cement, but it's not the whole thing. Bill uses cement a little later on in the book when he starts talking about after you do an inventory, he asks if you made mortar without sand. right? There's a proper proportion to create hard, rock-solid cement. All right? And he's talking about the cement which binds us together. One element of that, right, is the issues, is the problems. But what's the next element? What else goes into all of this to create the solution to alcoholism? The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I come in hurting and badly mangled, as the book would call it, from active alcoholism, and I walk in here and there's hope, right? That was what it just told me. There's hope, there's a democracy, right, that prevails the vessel, and then it tells me that there's a solution. And that's the great news this book covers. Right? How many times have you ever gone to an AA meeting and not see anybody smile? Not have anyone tell you the great news. Here's great news. You're super sick. And that's great news because you found a solution. It's here. You can get well because you're breathing in and out. You're still alive. There's hope. God is good. Right? That, like, what? Why? When a lot of times there's a general tone to most Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and it's monotone. Right? Like, why? What's the issue? Why can't I be happy about God giving me something I could not do for myself? And who am I to hold that in? Let's put it on the table for the newcomer right now. You can get well. You never have to feel this way ever again. Ever again. Right? And there's a solution to how you feel. There's the promise. There's the hope. Right? I have to know what I suffer from. If I know what I suffer from, I can get better. Right? If I have a runny nose, I don't suffer from a runny nose. I suffer from lack of immunity from whatever's attacking my immune system. Whatever the deep cause condition of the illness is. Just because I put alcohol into my system doesn't mean alcohol is the problem. It's a solution to the problem. Interesting wording, right? Alcohol, the liquid solution to my problem. Then I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and this chapter says there is a solution and it ain't liquid. It is a spirit, though, right? They call it wine and spirits, right? So it's funny, your parallel, right? So you come in here with the spirit of alcohol, right? Alcohol is your God, right? And then you come in here, get a little blast of hope, hopefully, that you can get better, that things can get better, right? And then you learn all of a sudden, it's like, you don't have to do anything all that really different. You just have to find a different spirit. Right? And yet we want to complicate it, though. Right? We want to complicate it. Oh, describe to me what your higher power, what qualities you're looking for in your higher power. It's like, whoa, where does it say that in the book? It doesn't. It's one of your understanding. That's it. Not me hoping to understand your understanding. That doesn't make any sense. That's not what this is about. It's not defined. It's not exact. It is between your ears and in your heart. And that's it. And if there's no connection down into here, great news. That's the solution. This book carries the solution to those who suffer from alcoholism. Right? I have to know what alcoholism is, though. Right? That if I don't know what alcoholism is, I'm fighting the wrong enemy. Every time I fought alcohol and its derivatives, 9 times out of 9, I lost. Once I learn to fight the proper enemy, which is my mind, which tells me alcohol is a good idea, right? Once I learn to fight the proper enemy, we're in a good spot. Now there's a simple understanding that I can't fix me. If I could fix me, I would have done it at consequence number one. You guys all remember consequence number one? Typically it's the parents catching you or something. Something that's, you know, or getting caught at the school with like a gin and Sprite at the dance or something. Who knows? Whatever your first consequence. Maybe it was worse. I don't know. But whatever consequence one was, if it was really bad enough, I would have just been like, oh yeah, next time I was presented with an opportunity to put alcohol in my system again, I would have done, which I wish we could do. I'm a real alcoholic. I don't have an opportunity to be able to do this. Play the tape all the way through. You ever hear anyone say that? That's a lie. If you're a real alcoholic, that's a lie. You literally can't. And the book tells us, and we're going to look at that on page 24. When we go to page 24, there's a paragraph up there in important squiggly letters. Smart people call it italics. We read it a couple weeks ago, but it bears repeating. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Okay, great. Now, let's kind of play back what we've said already. We've come into AA. There's some hope because we're still alive, right? We realize the spirit of alcohol brought us into here, and we realize that that another spirit can lift us out. Okay, great. So far, so good, right? Now, we round the corner, and we got to figure out what the real problem is. My willpower is non-existent. My brain can't, with sufficient force, bring about the memory or humiliation of even a week or a month ago. Right? We are without defense against the first drink. There you go. How about a little, again, we're talking about a little battle analogy here. It's literally no defense against the first drink. Now, you're either going to take that one of two ways. You're going to hear that sentence, you're going to be like, wow, I guess I'm screwed. Or two, wow, at least I know it's not my fault. Right? There's two different avenues by which you can do this. And it doesn't matter, both of which are effective at getting us to the next level. It doesn't really matter. But a lot of times there's really two reactions. I'm screwed, or wow, look what I did. Right? So if we think we've got a defense against the first drink, there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't get me wrong, that can wake up in the morning and choose to stay sober. I'm just not built that way, unfortunately. I've lost the power of choice in drink. That's what it just told me. I'm a real alcoholic. That means I can't choose whether I drink or not. So I'm without defense against the first drink. So the idea would be, well, where do we get that defense? How do I know I'm real alcoholic? Right? Then we flip to page 44 and we qualify. Right? We got to qualify the real alcoholic first. Let's make sure we have a full-blown understanding of what it is that a real alcoholic is and is not. In the preceding chapters, you have learned, this is the first paragraph, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. Here we go. If you're highlighting, underlining, memorizing, this is a great spot. If a newcomer says, I don't know if I'm really alcoholic, hold on 1 second, let me flip open to page 44, we'll figure it out real quick. All right? If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. Bingo. And you could formulate that into a question. It's a very simple, right? When you try to, you know, when you honestly want to, when you want to not drink anymore, have you been able to do that? Well, maybe for like, I'm good for 2 weeks personally. That's just me. I can white knuckle with the best of them for 2 weeks. Right? And then talk about suffering. Like, we like to talk about suffering while we're drinking. The untreated alcoholic mind is real suffering. That's torture. Absolute torture. Right? And then it says, and then when drinking, right? Because that's typically the path we'll take next. Right? I try to stop on my own, and then when I start drinking again, I have little control over the amount you take. You're probably alcoholic. Here's the solution. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. How about that verbiage? Bring that up at your next open discussion meeting and see how far that goes. It'll go over like a lead balloon. Watch. So it's like, oh, do anyone have any topics? Yeah, I'm an alcoholic, and it turns out that I'm suffering from a spiritual illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Can we talk about that? And most people are like, yeah, let's talk about that. But your run-of-the-mill AA, right, they're not going to know how to answer that question. They're not going to understand. They're going to say, well, all I do is go to meetings. Okay, which might be a place to find a little taste of some spirit. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Again, we already discussed it. We walk into AA, there's some hope, right? We are some folks that have just been rescued from the liner of the accident or the shipwreck, right? So there's automatic hope there. There's automatic positivity just in that alone, right? A collective intelligence, as Bill calls it, right? Like a more of a the hippies would call it a good vibe, right? Because all of us have kind of the same goal, right? Is to, for this entire hour and 15 minutes or hour and a half, not put alcohol in our system, right? Even if it's just that little bit of time, at least there's that, right? There's definitely that. So now there's your qualification as alcoholic. So what did we learn? We learned there's hope in here, but you've got to take action. Remember, it said brotherly and harmonious action, right? It's not contemplation. It's not thinking. It's action. We have to do something, right? It's like having to dig a ditch. We could sit there and stare at the earth and hope that it gets better. The ditch will not get dug. It's like anything else. You could, theoretically, go to a restaurant, get the menu, memorize the menu, right? The waitress can come up to you, ask you what you want. You order the food, and then when the food gets brought to the table, you don't touch a lick of it, and you could leave hungry. Right? I mean, it's literally the same thing. I could, you know, I was in and out of AA. I had How It Works memorized because we read it at every meeting. The preamble, sure, I could memorize a little bit of that, right? I could talk a good talk at an AA meeting, but I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't eating what you guys were offering, right? Maybe I couldn't hear through the noise of what was being offered. Maybe I wasn't ready yet. There's a lot of maybes, right? But at the same time, that I couldn't see the forest through the trees. Right? That's where I was at. And I needed to go through a little bit more suffering to get to the point of, as the book again says, badly mangled. Right? It says alcohol became the great persuader. Right? And what does that mean? Alcohol is a great, meaning alcohol knocked me into a state of reasonableness, as the book says. Interesting way to put it. So alcohol, then, I could be grateful for where alcohol brought me. Because if alcohol didn't bring me where it brought me, then I would not be where I am today. Right? There's a level of gratitude in that that is foreign to most people. Right? I have said and will say, hopefully, until my dying day, that drugs and alcohol are the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Because without that, without those things, there's a few things that I don't have today. One is I don't have this relationship I have with my higher power. Two is the relationship I have with my family, my kids, my wife. Without those things, without being beaten into a state of reasonableness, I'd never been able to get to a point where I'm at with my family. And three, I would never be able to speak to the newcomer and have them know with absolute certainty I know what I'm talking about and they don't have to feel this way anymore. Right? So not only do you could look at it that way, and I've been called many different names for saying things like that in AA, and I have no problem with that, and that's okay. That's where your journey took you. My experience takes me where my experience takes me. It's hard to argue somebody else's experience. Rock on, right? The good news is we've got hope. We've got answers. There is a way to get better. So now, I know what I'm probably pretty cool with what alcoholic is, conceptually, right? Here's the thing. I could sit down with a newcomer and I could read this and they'll look at me, you know, okay. But here's what really is a message of depth and weight. What we can all carry to the newcomer of Alcoholics Anonymous. Every single one of us in here, I don't care what step you're on, I don't care if you've never taken a step, one thing we can carry to every single newcomer is we know what it feels like to be where they're at. Bless you. We know what it feels like to be where they're at. Like my mother, she's a wonderful human being. She does not know what it feels like to be alcoholic. Right? My you know, some doctors, some therapists, psychologists, people who spend their entire lives trying to help people like us don't know what it feels like to be alcoholic. They don't know. Me, a 12th grade education, getting kicked out of community college, can win over the entire confidence of a newcomer in about 5 minutes. Because I know what it feels like to be there. I sat in that seat. I know what it's like to feel like the loneliest person in a room full of people. I know what it's looked like, what it feels like to look into your mother's eyes and see despair and pain. I know what that feels like. All of our stories are very different. right? Some of us, you know, we're jails, institutions, right? Some of us locked up, right? Some of us not. Some of us detoxing on mom's couch. Some of us, wherever your journey brought you, none of that matters. None of it. But we know what it feels like to be in it. And most importantly, if I can describe what it feels like to be in it, I better be able to describe what it feels like not being in it anymore. Because that's where the hope is, right? So I can describe what it's like in it. I can describe what it's like not in it. Now we've got this purpose-driven life. That's what AA is. AA is the ability to say, hey, I see you're down in that hole down there. I'm going to jump in there with you because I know a way out. Right? In the trenches. Right? It's very easy, and I've done this, it's very easy to get looped into this speaker mentality and, you know, from the podium, trying to get people well from the podium and big book studies and all that. And that's great. And there's a good, you know, there's motivation is fine and it's helpful. And it might get people on the right track or asking the right questions. But there is nothing like sitting one-on-one with a newcomer to Alcoholics Anonymous or someone who's been around a while that hasn't been inundated with a solution. Doesn't matter what new is. Right. Either way, sitting down with someone and discussing what it feels like, the pain, and then discussing what it feels like to hope, right? And then being able to have an intelligent conversation about something like that. There is nothing like watching the light bulb come on in the newcomer. When all of a sudden they're like, oh my God, if this knucklehead can do it, I can do it. Right? And then the question becomes, what do I gotta do? Right? So then when we flip over, we're on page 60. Right, so after we read how it works, and typically a lot of run-of-the-mill or every other AA meeting, they read how it works, which we read last week and broke it down a little bit. Now, the follow-up to all that is, what's next? So down a little, about two-thirds of the way to the bottom, being convinced we were at step 3. Which is we have decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? There is explicit and exact directions for step 3. Coming up. It literally just told me. I'm a little confused by step 3. Yeah, no problem. Page 60 down at the bottom. Let's get to it. Right? Me trying to explain my third step experience to anyone does no one any good. It might do me good. It might make me feel a little bit better. But what does that mean? Doesn't mean anything to the newcomer. They don't care. Really. Like, they're hurting bad. It's like someone who's... What we get to do is we get to perform triage. Right? With the newcomer. Right? So it's like if we're talking about, in war... Right? And someone gets a bullet to their leg. It's life-threatening if you let it go for a little while. Right? And they're laying over there and I walk over and I got a tourniquet so I can stop the bleeding, right? And I sit there and tell them about the experience I had when I got shot in the leg. They're going to be like, stop my bleeding, please. I'll hear that story later. This hurts like hell. Can we tighten this off a little bit? Right? So we get to perform triage in here. That's what we get to do. We get to close up some wounds a little bit. Right? At least give them some hope. We'll tie the thing tight, solder it shut, and say, all right, God's got the rest, but you're going to have to put some action in to get there. Right? So that's really what we get to perform. So step 3 is two different things in the book, right? Really, really important. One, it's the first time it tells you you're at a step in the big book. Like, you know, like I mentioned this before, like in the mall where it has that little arrow that says you are here, right? This is the first time in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous it tells you you're at a step. It doesn't ever tell you you're at step 1. It doesn't ever tell you you're at step 2. Because those two steps are conceptual. In fact, what we discussed up to this point are really the first two steps. Powerlessness, unmanageability, right? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. All I have to do is replace that. Came to believe that the power of alcohol could restore me to sanity to the power of something else. It's funny, people are like, I can't get down with this higher power concept. Like, didn't you just get out of detox? You signed that little sheet. You gave them power over your life. You know exactly what it's like to give your will and your life over to an institution. What's the difference? Right? It's the same thing. It's just we don't want to hurt the newcomer's feelings, so we don't want to tell them that way. And two, like it's just a different way to look at things. You can't look at things the same way and expect it to look different. Right? It's like this microphone. We all see this microphone, right? It's right here. It's right in front of us, but we all have a view of it. My perception on this microphone is certainly different than your guys's. And yet we're looking at the same thing. So if I'm looking at this as the issues, right? If this is my shortcomings and defects of character or whatever, my resentments, my envies, my angers, my jealousies, my lusts, so I'm looking right at it, and I've been looking at it this way the entire time, I'm not going to be able to do anything different. My perception has to shift. I have to look at it from an entirely different angle. And that's what the book says. If I look at this from an entirely different angle, I'm a much better shot at getting better, right? So, and also with the third step, the second thing that's different from any other step in the book is that it's telling you have to be convinced you're at step three before you can even take step three. It's the only step that does that. So it seems rather important that we hammer home some ideas on step three. The first requirement, a requirement already. Great, let's see how this one goes. Is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Right? On that basis, which means self-will, on that basis we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more than likely to have varied traits. So now he's telling me, what do I try to do? What am I trying to manage? I'm trying to manage everything. Right? Just tell me what I want to hear and everything's going to be okay. Right? And then when this person, right, this theoretical person sitting here, right, which I imagine my spouse, because this is where I do this most, by the way, right? Just tell me I'm handsome and give me some food, right? Like something like that, right? Just, that's all I want. That's really all I want. And then that happens, God forbid. Now what? I don't know, bring it up a level, right? And then ask for, something else. And then something else. And then something else. And then when she doesn't deliver on all of these things that I piled on top of her plate, now all of a sudden it's like, all right, gotcha. It's your fault I'm angry. It's your fault I'm upset. Right? It's your fault I'm restless, irritable, discontent. Your fault now. Ha! I take it off of me. Right? That's exactly what he's describing here. The actor trying to arrange the ballet, the lights, right? Everything. Move that light over here and do this and do that. And some of us can do this kind of thing at our occupation. And possibly at a very high level, right? That's we're talking about something very, very different here, right? Maybe in my occupation that's needed. Maybe I need to run the department. Maybe I need to put things here and have somebody do this, and I get to delegate things. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about life. Life would be okay if I could delegate everything and everything would be happy. But what usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. There's an underrated sentence in this book. Things aren't going well. Let me double down. You see politicians do it all the time, right? Let me double down on this. It's not going over well. I got this. I can fix it. I just have to exert myself more. I just have to put me in more. It's like, man, there's too much salt in this batter. Where's the salt? Let's put some more in. Like, that's literally
exactly what we do. I could just put more in and I'll be fine. It'll work out. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. That's a very chameleon kind of way. It's a subtle form, maybe not so subtle. I'm going to call it subtle. Subtle form of manipulation. Right? I'll be gracious to you and I'll get what I want. I'll be angry and demanding of you and I'll get what I want. Right? What are both scenarios get? What I want. That's the end goal. If just give me what I want and tell me what I want to hear, everything's going to be fine. Right? It's like a small kid. I've got three of those in my house. Right? Very much like that. All right? Very similar. They just don't know they're doing it yet. But when I do it, I know I'm doing it. Especially with been sober a couple 24s. I know when I'm trying to manipulate. I know when I'm trying to get one over. I know when I'm trying to get somebody to say what I want them to say. I know it. And it hurts my soul. Right? I might not acknowledge that it's hurting my soul, but every time I do it, it just tacks in a little bit more. A little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. Then all of a sudden, it will create, seemingly out of thin air, a resentment. Then that one resentment, resentment's a Latin word from the word sentar, which means to feel. Right, so a resentment needs to re-feel the same emotion over and over and over again, whether it's real or imagined. Ooh, that's the caveat too. I might just be making it up. And yet, I got a resentment. And it tells me that resentments kill more alcoholics than anything else. Right, from it stem all forms of spiritual disease. Think about that for a second. Right? Just a couple little I's, my's, and me's. I'm a few selfish acts from a resentment. I'm a few resentments away from a drink. And I'm maybe one drink away from death. Right? If we're going to play it that way and think about it, just as deadly as the drink is doing this. If you really want to think about it that way, or is it, how many of these can I get away with before I get a resentment, right? We're literally dousing gasoline, seeing how close to the fire we can get before we catch flame, right? That's quite literally what we're doing, right? And yet, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal because, well, I'm sober. I'm not drinking, right? And yet, we're trying to bend and twist the world. So when I'm reading about step three, it's not just for the newcomer. I think I'm making that point pretty clear. It's literally about every day, every time, every interaction, every thought reverts back. This is another thing about step three. It asks you throughout the entire book to remember what you did in step three. Remember, we're willing to go to any lengths. Remember, right? It tells us, especially in step nine. It makes us revert back to step three and step nine a lot. There's like four or five different times in the book where it says, hey, you should probably think about that what you talked about in step three, right? Self-will, hardly be a success, right? You were convinced, right? You're the actor, right? Remember, like it's like the book has a little sponsorship element to it. Sponsors are always good for that. Hey, remember that time you told me that this sounds about the same? Like, ah, yeah, you're right. Right, so here we are now. Let's, still does not, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that others are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? The word rest with a W means to wring out with force. Right, so if it's like if you have like a hand towel that's wet and you try to wring it out, get all the water out, that's what the word rest means. Right, so it's an aggressive like twist, like that's what that word means. So let's read that sentence again, knowing what that word means. Is he not a victim of the delusion? This is of the mind, right? A delusion is a truth to me. It speaks to me in my voice. It speaks to me in my language, and I understand it. That's what a delusion is. That I can struggle through, right? That I can wring out satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well, right? If my life is unmanageable, and now it's again, it's reverting back to even the concept of step one here, right? So it's like, I'm just going to exert myself harder. I'm just going to just wring out any bit of satisfaction or happiness. How's that working for you? Right? That's really the question if we're going along doing this stuff. Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Those questions, there's a lot of yeses in there, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, right? Even with the newcomer, they'll be like, yeah, I get that. That makes sense. Yes, this is exactly what I'm trying to do. Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people call it nowadays. Why that little bit is in there, it's important. We've got to take a historical context to this sentence, right? When we're talking about the ego, this is coming from Sigmund Freud, right? Early days of psychology, right? So the ego and the superego, right? So this is a very new kind of concept. A lot of the big book stuff, someone who worked with Sigmund Freud didn't have a great relationship with him. They didn't really like each other all that much, Freud and Carl Jung. Carl Jung was very deep into spirituality and the ways of the mind and the spirit. Freud was not. He thought you can induce chemically what Jung you could get prayer and through God, right? So there's a vast difference between the two and their ideologies, and I don't mean to get too deep in this, but when it says egocentric, and then they put this little part in, as people like to call it nowadays, because that was new when this book was written. Remember, this book was written between 1937 and 1930. It was printed in 39. Right, so it was very early on in the days of psychology. There wasn't a lot of psychologists in the day, right? The biggest names were obviously Freud, Jung, William James. You know, those were the kind of the early on kind of trendsetters here to this. So that's why that sentence is in here, just to give us some historical context. He's like the retired businessman who lulls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia, capital U implies godly, implies heaven, is really kind of where he's going after, Valhalla, call it whatever you want, like that sort of perfectness above all. That's kind of what he's going with utopia. Page 61, about to go on to page 62. If the rest of the world would only behave. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, or our self-pity. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Right? So he's gearing up to tell us what the real problem is. Well, we've got to understand, if something is the root of our troubles, this is an analogy, right? And where does a plant get its nutrition from? The roots. Right? If the plant can start out as healthy as can be, but if it doesn't have a healthy root system, and if it doesn't have healthy soil around it, it's not going to grow to its potential. Now, here's another little fun factoid about plants. You put it in a small pot, right? It's only going to grow as far as the width of its roots. Same with trees. You'll know, and it's cool. Look this up. If you look at any tree, at the widest point of the tree is as far out as the roots go. Not as far down, but as far out. Right? So if the tree is capped off for whatever reason in how far out the roots can go, then it can't grow any bigger. Right? So if the question would be, right, if our problem, right, is telling us the selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of my troubles. The question is, where am I getting my quote-unquote nutrition from? Right? Where is that coming from? If it's coming from a capped source, which is human in nature, right? Whether that's me or my codependent relationship with any X number of people, right? Whatever that might be, it's a capped source. There's only so much room for those roots to grow, right? So that being said, we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Driven by them, right? And that told us that in just a few sentences ago that we are probably, most of us are like driven by self-propulsion. Not the alcoholic, though. Right? It says most people are driven by self-propulsion. Here's what the alcoholic is driven by. There's 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. 100 forms! I don't even know why you said 100. It's probably infinite. If you can make it up in your mind, there's no limit to what we're driven by. We are driven by, again, if you list your things in here, whatever it might be, but that's what's propelling us. That's what's pushing us. That's what's driving us. By driving, think about it literally. If you sit into if you get into a cab or into an Uber, you're being driven by somebody else. And you're at, quote unquote, their mercy. Really? Wherever they take you, that's where you end up. Is it the right destination? I guess we'll find out when we get there. Right? If we're driven by these things, it's the same thing. We're going to be driven by these, and our relationships are going to be driven by these. Right? What's the one commonality with all my relationships? Me. Me. And if all my relationships aren't that good, what's the one commonality with all my relationships? Me. What am I bringing to the party? Fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. No one wants to hang out with that. Like if I told you, hey, you can hang out with this person, they're super cool. They tell jokes, there's a lot of fun stuff. Or you can hang out with this person who's fear-based and full of self-pity. Which one are you going to hang out with, right? It's like, you'll probably hang out with the fun person is my thought, right? So, but we're driven by these things, and we don't even really know it, and yet our relationships are no good, and yet we're step on the toes of our fellows, and now they're retaliating, and it's like, well, why are they mad at me? What did I do? You know, and yet all I'm bringing to the party is just selfishness and self-centeredness. And I haven't been able to kind of loop together that that's the reason why they're retaliating against me. I usually am the one that starts the ball rolling on that stuff. Now, again, there's going to be some occasions where I'm gracious and some occasions where I'm virtuous, right? There's going to be other occasions where I'm not. So on those occasions where I think I'm being really good to this person, it's like, well, why are they so mad at me? Maybe they see through what you're trying to do here. Maybe they see you trying to manipulate them. Maybe they figured it out. Right? That was always one of my biggest fears when I was out there in active alcoholism, was that someone's going to figure it out. Right. If someone figures me out, I'm going to have to just ditch them and move on. Because I'd much rather live in the gray, shady area where someone might not be able to figure out exactly what it is that I'm trying to do. Right. So that's, so now we're at this whole step three area. And let's read a little bit further. What time do I go until again?
7:30.
Okay, perfect. We've got enough time. Okay. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. We're not just an example of self-will run riot. We're an extreme example of self-will run riot. I look at the difference of skateboarding and extreme skateboarding. One is like, well, you will probably die if you fall. Right? That's just the word extreme being placed in there, just so ever so seemingly nonchalantly, just really, really hammers home what we're up against. I'm not just an example of self-will run riot. I'm an extreme example of it. Right? And that's what I'm bringing to all these relationships. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of selfishness. We must, or it kills us. Whew. There's a death threat if I've ever heard one. Right? I've talked about this before. Like I love reading the promises at meetings. I swear I'm going to do this one day. I'm going to go through the book and I'm going to highlight all the death threats. And we're going to have a death threat meeting. And we're like it's just because. Like again, like it, what is it telling me? I must or it kills. AA is just about suggestions. Oh, it is. How about we read page 62 and tell me that's a suggestion? And how does he, right, the author, Bill, and his little cohorts, have the audacity to say something like this?
Because if you remember in Bill's story, someone hung themselves in Bill's living room. He was watching people die. He was on the front lines. Before there was a solution. Before there was much of anything. There were some religious ideas. Like there was the Washingtonians in the beginning. Then they got a little political and fizzled out. Then there was the Oxford group, which was where everyone kind of got together. Again, a religious organization, right? But like that's how it all kind of started. That's where it all kind of gelled from. But he was watching people die. Like slow, painful deaths. This is during this time, if you look at the suffering of the alcoholic, it was immense, right? These days, we don't get a ton of cases of wet brain. I don't know if you guys are familiar with wet brain, but they got a lot of it then. And a lot of it because the alcohol wasn't, first of all, wasn't legal during Prohibition. So what were they doing? They were making it. They called it bathtub gin. And if mixed improperly, you could go blind. Right? And can you imagine what the havoc that's ripping through people's livers? Like it's probably horrific. Right? And if you could go back and interview a guy like Dr. Silkworth and say, hey, what's an alcoholic death look like? He'd probably have some pretty strong descriptors for you. He'd probably be able to tell you, this is exactly what it looks like. This is how many times I've seen it. This is how often it's happening. Right? So at that time, when Prohibition was rocking and rolling, right, alcoholism was a major epidemic. It changed the constitution of our country twice. The founding document of our country, it changed it twice. 18th Amendment and the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution had to do with alcohol. It was a political problem. Now, when it comes to a social problem, there were these alcoholic men they were the breadwinners of the household. They would get their checks. They would go to the salons, saloons, delicatessens. They would go to wherever, the bars, the underground clubs. They would drink away their entire paycheck and go home with nothing. Right? Oh, well, why doesn't the wife go out and work? Because they didn't really do that, one. And two, it was the Great Depression. No one was working. Bread lines, right? Starving folks, right? One of the worst times in our country's history. Right? And when the bottom fell out of the stock market in 1928 or 29, it was not good. Outlook was bleak. If ever there was a time when God saw fit to place a solution to alcoholism in this world, that was it. And here we are. Right, with a stockbroker and a proctologist got together in Akron, Ohio. Right, when they finally met. Bob didn't even get sober after they met. He went out and drank again in the great state of New Jersey in Atlantic City. And then when he got home, he made all of his amends in one day because that was the one part of the program he was not interested in doing. And that's the day, right? July 10th. 1935, July 10th, right? That's Founders Day. The day of Dr. Bob's permanent sobriety. Not the day they met, but Dr. Bob's permanent sobriety. So now, 1935, fresh off the heels of Prohibition, fresh off the heels of the Great Depression. I'm not even off the heels yet. There's probably still a lot of remnants of it, right? So from there, these two cats meet and radically change the way that the world will view addictions and alcoholism forever. If that's not divinely inspired, I do not know what is. It makes a pretty darn strong case that God saw fit to place the solution to alcoholism right then and there, and place it in such a way and put it in a book to where we can't screw it up. Jury's still out on that. However, here it is. Here's the solution. Bang. It's right in front of us. We've got it right here. Right? And how many other 12-step fellowships are there? Over 200. How many of you use this book? Most of them. They just change a word or two every now and then. That's really it. It's got the directions on how to get well. Right? And so on our third step traveling here, right, it says, now we got to see what's the solution, right? It must or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without His aid. Many of us had moral, which means knowing the difference between right and wrong, philosophical, right? So that's our mental convictions, right? Convictions galore that we could not live up to them, and even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own willpower. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. Right? So I have to be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And the first requirement is that I be convinced of that. That's my requirement, first one. Next, right, is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that the hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. Now, this paragraph is really important to understand contextually with what Bill used as references to write the book. He used a dictionary that he got when he went to law school. He used a Bible. And he also used a book by Emmett Fox called Sermon on the Mount. Now, that they used to go see Emmett Fox on Friday nights at the Hippodrome in New York when Bob was in New York. He would take Bill there. So any word, and what it says in the last sentence of the foreword of that book is that any word that's capitalized implies God. Let's look at this paragraph through that lens. God is going to be our director, capitalized D for director. He is the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of a new and triumphant arch to which we pass to freedom. Keystone, right? So if an arch, right, the keystone is this shaped stone that goes up into the middle that connects the arches. It makes it an actual arch, right? Through which we pass to freedom. Like, that's a promise, right? This is the principle. This is the thing. This is, as the kids say, the bee's knees. This is what we need to have. We need to have this. And he gives you multiple concepts that you can wrap possibly your mind around. Maybe one of these. Director, not a bad one. Principal, okay, we've all had those. Right? Father, children, right? And next, there's even more. On the next paragraph, employer, right? That's another one. He just drips these all the way through the text. Sometimes you might go, you know what, director makes sense. I kind of like that. Or employer, that's cool. I can wrap my mind around that. All right, great. Boom. Keep it moving. So when it comes to step three, we have to look at this stuff. And not only that, let's kind of shift our perception. Maybe you've been sober a couple 24s. Maybe you've been doing some step work. Maybe you haven't. Whatever the case is, we can take our everyday life and run it through the lens of step three and see where we're really at. Right? See where we're really at. And then ask ourselves the simple question, right? Where am I getting my ease and comfort from? Where is that ease? When I feel easy and comfortable, is that coming from God, or is that because of something material on this earth that I somehow think that I created? Right. So, thanks guys for having me. Awesome. Next week we'll do some step four work a little bit. So, appreciate you. Thank you.